Members, let's call this meeting to order. First of all, we have a quorum, so can I have someone move the minutes?
Madam Chair, I'll move the minutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Nels. Is there any corrections, or it looks like it's fine? So, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Okay, minutes are moved. Today, members, we are going to honor Charles and Margene Hendricks for their contribution to agriculture. They have joined us today, and Charles and Margene, would you mind standing up to let us know who you are? There you go. Thank you for coming today.
Oh, you're welcome.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you. Well, I have a resolution to read, so if you'd like to relax for a second, we'll read that. And it says, whereas those who work hard to feed and supply our nation through agriculture are deserving of special legislative recognition. And whereas Charles Hendricks and his wife Margene both grew up on family farms in 1974, Charles purchased his first beehive and made yearly increases of hives in order to make a sideline business of beekeeping to supplement the farm income. And whereas eventually Charles gained experience running larger numbers of colonies and designed an extracting facility on the farmstead. And whereas when the fellow beekeeper's operation was available for sale in 1987, Charles and Margene left farming and became full-time commercial beekeepers, naming their business C.M. Hendricks Apiaries. And whereas in the past 28 years, Charles and Margene have managed 1,800 colonies on 60 locations in 5 Minnesota counties, and their annual honey production is around 150,000 pounds. They also provide crucial pollination services to growers of fruits and vegetables and beeswax to Minnesotans who farm and market candles. And whereas the environmental changes in farming practices have affected bee health, but through care and management, the colonies were maintained, and recently the majority of the hives and equipment were sold as Hendricks entered semi-retirement. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration of the House of Representatives of the State of Minnesota that it thanks and commends Charles and Margene Hendricks for their contribution to agriculture and extends best wishes for them in the future. Congratulations and thank you. Representative Clark, would you like to, or Representative Johnson, excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to add to that. I was the one who nominated this fine couple. And I just like, you know, that really says it well, what they've contributed as agricultural leaders. But, you know, the fact that these folks are born, you know, sons and daughters of Nicollet County farmers, and they still maintain the Frendel Farm, where I'd like to add they recently added a wetland, and it's a beautiful place. But they're really leaders not only in the beekeeping, but also in quality food and conservation, and they do it really well. And the resolution mentions that they managed the beekeeping business. These two people did the beekeeping business with a little bit of help from their family and some friends and some a little bit of hired help. But I don't know of any. I think everybody who knows Chuck and Margene say they're about as hardworking as anybody, and they're really quality leaders. And thank you to the committee for the opportunity to recognize them for this leadership. I think it's a really nice idea. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you to the Hendricks. Do you have any comments to make at all?
I'd just like to thank you for this. The beekeeping industry, a lot of times, it's a segment of agriculture that isn't understood very well. And this recognition does validate what we've done, all the work we've done over these years, and does also recognize the value of pollinators to supplying food for Minnesota and all the United States. And really, I'm glad for your support of alternative types of agriculture and hopefully other types, because really some of the alternative types of agriculture are still really the only truly small family farms really left. So it really is important.
Well, thank you very much for your dedication to agriculture and very important part of Minnesota. Well, members, I guess we better get started with our first testifier. We have the Turkey Growers Association coming to join us. Is Mr. Gordon in the, is he here? Would you like to join us? Would you say your name and identify your your connection?
John Gordon, I'm a turkey grower.
Have a seat. Okay. Thank you very much. That's okay.
John Gordon, I'm a turkey grower from Pelican Rapids, and I'm a president of the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Would you like to identify yourself for the record?
Yeah, my name is Scott Waldner. I'm president of the Chicken and Egg Association of Minnesota. I'll be after
Great. Well, go ahead, Mr. Gordon.
Chairman Keel and members of the committee, for the record, I'm John Gordon. I serve as the president of the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association, or the MTGA. I'm a third-generation turkey farmer, and together with my parents, my wife Trudy, and our two teenage sons, Blaine and Jay, we raise 125,000 turkeys near Pelican Rapids. Today I'll provide you with a brief history of our organization and an overview of Minnesota's turkey industry. 2014 marked the 75th anniversary of the Turkey Growers Association. We are a dues-based membership organization with the primary function of providing education to members and tracking legislative and regulatory affairs. This includes providing input to the legislature and regulatory agencies that strengthens our farmers' ability to maintain and grow their farm businesses. Minnesota is the top turkey-producing state in the U.S. In 2014, Minnesota turkey farmers raised 45 million turkeys, which translates into about 1.2 billion pounds of turkeys. Minnesota is home to 450 turkey growers, which is more than any other state. As with all of agriculture, raising turkeys has changed considerably. 75 years ago, turkeys were raised seasonally and outdoors. It took about 21 weeks to raise a tom. Weeks to raise a 21-pound tom, or a male turkey. Now, in 21 weeks, we can raise a tom turkey to 45 pounds. So that's more than twice the size in the same amount of time, and we use half the feed today as we did then. Furthermore, the bird generates less manure, which today is recognized as a valuable nutrient for crops. As a matter of fact, some years turkey growers make more money selling their manure than we do selling our turkeys. The reason for this reduced carbon footprint is not the use of hormones or steroids. There's a common pervasive myth among consumers that turkeys are fed or injected with hormones and steroids. This absolutely is not the case. It's illegal, and there is none available. There are three primary factors for more productive turkeys. One, improved bird health through better living environment. Two, selectively breeding birds that have more meat and stronger skeletal structure. And three, better diets. Through research, we are able to provide what our turkeys need exactly when they need it. The University of Minnesota's College of Agriculture, Food and Natural Resource Sciences, CFANS, has been a national leader in turkey nutrition and very important to our success. Our top priorities are food safety and bird health, which lead to grower profitability. The University of Minnesota CFANS, College of Veterinary Medicine, Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, and the State of Minnesota's Board of Animal Health are important partners that help us achieve these priorities, and one of the four major reasons why Minnesota ranks first in the U.S. in turkey production. These entities are part of the infrastructure that has helped us overcome challenges time and again. They have worked together with us to identify, monitor, control, and eradicate diseases and improve our flock health, management, and environmental protection. Three of our legislative priorities involve strengthening their ability to continue to have the capacity to help us and the rest of Minnesota agriculture meet future challenges. Our issues brief lists support for the $30 million of recurring funds to invest in building agriculture productivity research, an additional $4 million in funding for the U of M's Rapid Ag Response Fund, which funds research on emerging production issues, and $18 million in bonding to replace existing animal isolation units, which are critical for animal health research. A second major factor in the success of the turkey industry is the balance of turkey production and processing. Growers need access to close markets, and processors need a steady supply of raw product, which in this case is turkeys. Minnesota is home to three processing companies: Genio Turkey Store, a subsidiary of Hormel Foods; Turkey Valley Farms, which is a grower-owned corporation located in Marshall; and Northern Pride, which recently celebrated their 25th anniversary as a grower-owned cooperative in Thief River Falls. A legislative issue of particular importance to our markets is the condition of county and township roads and bridges. Properly maintained and built to weight requirements is crucial for us to get feed trucks to our farms and loadout trucks back to the processing plant. A third reason for our success is our proximity to corn and soybeans, which are the primary ingredients in poultry feed. Feed makes up two-thirds to three-quarters of the cost of raising turkeys. We have a competitive advantage to other regions of the country because we are close to feed. Minnesota turkeys support nearly 1,800 corn and soybean farmers. Finally, our success comes from our growers. Many are second, third, fourth, and even fifth generation turkey farmers. As a whole, turkey growers are entrepreneurial and have a good business sense. As much as possible, they like to put their fate in their own hands by calculating risk and being rewarded by the market for taking those risks. They understand the business cycle and put money away in good years to help get through the bad years. As Paul Harvey said and was reiterated in last year's Dodge Super Bowl commercial, God bless the farmer. Our sustainability and future success depends upon our investment as an industry and state. So when that market conditions are right, we want a receptive business climate to be able to expand our production and processing capacity. Investment in research capacity that I mentioned a moment ago is key. Also key is recruiting and training our future workforce. Another initiative that we and other ag groups support are incentives to recruit and retain teachers of ag education and to expand the ag education curriculum into more schools. Recently, agriculture was listed as one of the top five college degrees for graduates. This is due in large part to the fact that agriculture has a demand for 55,000 employees each year, with only 25 to 30,000 graduates. Increasing ag education in middle and high school exposes more students to career opportunities, improves future consumers of food production systems, and the applied curriculum helps students better understand the application of core subjects of math, science, economics, and English. Chairwoman Keel, I thank you for the opportunity to provide you with an overview of Minnesota turkey farmers and processors.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gordon. Do we have any questions for our testifier? Representative Sundeed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Mr. Gordon, you mentioned the importance of the rural roads as far as servicing your farms with feed delivery and employees going up and down those roads. Last year, the legislature enabled the counties to levy a sales tax for road purposes. Do you know if in the counties where your major turkey production occurs, did any of those counties take advantage of that to improve their rural roads that don't receive state aid?
Mr. Gordon.
Chairwoman Keel, and I'm sorry I can't see your name.
Representative Sundin.
Representative Sundin, I don't have an answer for that. I don't know. I live in Otter Tail County, and Kandi Ohi County is our biggest turkey-producing county in the state, and I can't speak for I can't speak for Kandi Ohi County.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Anderson. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, I am sorry. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
That's okay.
we're good friends.
I'll live.
Mr. Gordon, thanks for mentioning the importance of ag education for all aspects of agriculture. And Minnesota is a top turkey-producing state of the nation. Can you talk about what's down the road in terms of expansion, the industry growing? Is it growing here in Minnesota in relation to other states around us?
I wouldn't say that, excuse me, Chairwoman Keel.
Sorry, Mr. Gordon, go ahead.
Representative Anderson. I wouldn't say that it's growing, but it's at a huge pace, but it's certainly maintaining with modest increases. Minnesota is a wonderful state to raise turkeys in. Very heavily invested by the processors, and they want to continue their industry here.
Representative Anderson?
Just to follow up, Madam Chair, we've had some discussions with the people in the industry, not just turkeys, but the livestock in general, and we're hearing in some cases that they can become permitted quicker in neighboring states, and we're concerned that we maintain our top rankings in some of these production areas. So do you see that as an impediment to expansion in Minnesota?
Chairwoman Keel, Representative Gordon. Anderson. One of our talking points is the Minnesota Pollution Controls Citizen Advisory Board and looking at a review of how that is done. To help the permitting process and speed things up, yes.
Representative Anderson, do you have any? Okay. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your testimony this morning. We've got kind of a bright, shining operation up in our district, Hanson Farms, and in their case, their size and scope requires that they maintain a national discharge permit. I know that Roger and his wife and brother quite well, and observed the huge amount of time and resource and expense to simply get that permit renewed, particularly, as you mentioned, the value of the turkey manure is quite high, and there's a huge relationship there with beef producers, alfalfa producers, because that's an excellent fertilizer. So is that an isolated situation, or do you see that as an issue within the industry? Not so much the new facility, which we hear a lot about the problems there, but what about just simply renewing that permit periodically, the costs and time involved?
Mr. Gordon.
Chairwoman Keel, Representative Lewick. I have two farms. One falls under the threshold of requiring the permit. The other one requires the permit with which you refer. I can say it's a time consumer. It's a permit to discharge. We don't discharge, so I'm getting a permit for something that I don't do or have any intention of doing. It's a time cost, and it's a time commitment, and it's an additional cost that I think should be reviewed.
Mr. Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, and for those committee members that aren't familiar, I hope you picked up on it isn't a question of whether his operation can discharge. Under those permits, the standard is zero discharge. So we've got a permit by definition allows no discharge, but it's a permit to discharge. But at any rate, that's in the weeds, but it's a huge issue. In other parts of the United States, they've recognized that there's no permit requirement there if the standard is no discharge for those types of operations, and we're not quite there yet in Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Luke. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gordon, thank you for being here this morning. I come from Candiota County, the number one turkey producer in the state and the number one producer in the world, I believe, of turkey production, so this is very important to me. I had some people from the turkey growers, excuse me, in my office before this meeting, and we had a discussion about we hope that it doesn't become the same path that we seen happen in California with some of the concerns that they have and how production of perhaps chickens also, I don't know if it was specifically just turkeys, but the and so I have a concern about that. So when you say that we have modest growth in Minnesota right now, how does that compare to perhaps the growth in Iowa, for example, or perhaps some other states that border us?
Mr. Gordon.
Chairman Keel, Representative Miller. I personally don't think that there's any state that can or will overtake the production of Minnesota that's increasing capacity. We're not increasing capacity for the sake of increasing capacity just to maintain our number one status. We also want to make sure that there's an end market for the product also. And the increases that are being, that we're doing in production is a result of the need on the other end for the sales for the consumer to buy the product. We're not just expanding, nor is any other state, just for the sake of trying to be or maintain number one status.
Representative Miller.
Madam Chair, Mr. Gordon, and I appreciate that. I know that you're a business, and you have to grow as the demand grows. What I'm concerned about is that as that demand grows, I want to make sure that production is growing here in this state. And so if there's anything that is an impediment to that, this is the sort of place that we need to hear about that. I think that's kind of why you're getting some of these questions here today. So thank you.
Mr. Gordon, did you have any comments?
Chairman Keel, Representative Miller, the permitting process that's been talked about, that would be one thing that could be looked at. And when a farm is interested in building another barn or building a couple barns on a different site, it's not that they want to do it tomorrow, but they certainly want to do it sooner than later, and red tape and hoops to jump through to slow the process down. If there's a way to look at it to revise things where, not that they can just blindly go out and expand, but with some review process, but within a timely manner.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I want to drill down on the rhetoric here, because we're hearing a lot of the same talking points. Is your permitting requirement, was it the CAFO requirements? Is it the federal requirement, or is it a state permit that you were referencing as taking time?
Chairman Keel, Representative Hansen, the NPDES is a
federal requirement, not a state requirement. So, Madam Chair, with the time, I'm trying to figure out what the time cost is. Is the time cost in preparing the application that you have to do before you submit it, or is the time after it's been submitted and then the agency is either not responding or is responding?
Chairman Keel, Representative Hansen, the time is both in the initial filling it out, and then there's a yearly year-end statement that is due to your area pollution control office. There's a year-end statement that's due that takes also a fair amount of time. So it's the initial and it's ongoing.
Representative Hansen.
And Madam Chair, so one part of it's probably that complexity, that it's just a complex application, and does the Pollution Control Agency have, in their regional staff, do they come out and provide assistance either in like an ombudsman way of helping with that form or helping with the permit, or is it come in and then there's just back and forth response? That's one question. And the second part of it is, when you're doing an expansion, does the local soil and water district provide any cost share or assistance that you guys can tap into manure management plans or holding or any other type of management?
Mr. Gordon.
Chairwoman Keel, Representative Hansen. I'm not going to say that there isn't help, but they have a lot of farms, a lot of customers. So it's not that they won't help you. It's not as easy as just calling them up or dropping into their office and taking 2-3 hours of their time. There is some help, but you're sort of on your own. And my personal experience in the 10 years or so that I've been doing these, the person that I deal with this year won't be the person that I deal with next year. Job transfers, promotions, this, that, and the other. And everybody interprets it a little bit differently because it's not a blanket turkey. It's for all species. And it's interpreted a little bit differently by everybody. And not impossible, but it's not the easiest thing I've done with either. And as far as expansion, I can't answer a question on that because I haven't built a new barn. So I can't answer about the cost sharing and stuff like that.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
And then finally, before I went on this line of questions, I actually had a question for Mr. Clavin on something else, but he's just been sitting in the audience, so I figured he might need to come down. But with the it appears that having knowledgeable agency staff in the field who have the experience and the ability to work with the producers, whether they're turkey or hog, or having folks and having that consistent, keeping them and having them not only be knowledgeable in the science but knowledgeable with the people they're working with and have that knowledge of doing is really the key. And I think that's whether it's a PCA or DNR or ag. And if we can find some way of providing that knowledge, because I think the permitting reform that was done went into actually effect about a month ago. The 90-day requirement went into reform only a month ago. So it's going to be hard to evaluate the outcomes of things that are shortly just changed within a month. But something that could be done over the long run with all the agencies is trying to make sure we've got people who can work with folks who are knowledgeable. And then you can't deny people promotions, but you can make it attractive to stay and work with folks and reward people who are knowledgeable and have that expertise that can assist. I think that's something we can do. Madam Chair, there was a commodity audit last year, and oftentimes when there are audits, it's kind of like the auditor's coming, everybody's scared about what can happen. And I think that the turkey producers had a good response to the audit, and I just wanted to get that on the record from Mr. Clavin, because maybe he could describe what they did in response to the legislative audit.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Clavin.
Thank you for the record. I'm Bruce Clavin. I represent the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association and the Chicken and Egg Association. This is just a question about the audit from last year. But quickly for members who don't know, the legislative auditor looked at the commodity checkoff councils for all of them, the program review for soybeans, corn, the rest of it. One of the findings last year was that the turkey council and growers were closely tied together. They share board members. And so what we've done since then is we had a working group over the summer, looked at a few options, and concluded that just simply dividing the board into two entities would be the way to go. That's been in motion. It was approved by our board in December. The Commissioner of Ag has signed off on the council side, and we're asking the membership to approve the bylaw changes at the annual meeting in March. So everything's in motion and should be wrapped up by then.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
And Madam Chair, I would applaud the turkey producers for their work and quick response on that, and I think it helps provide integrity to the system to have that wall between the promotion and the association areas. So thank you for the work you did on that, and I think it's a model.
Okay. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, I don't know all the details of the different types of permitting, but to address the reason why we're talking about permitting and perhaps educate you a little bit on it is I have had story after story after story of animal ag producers who are grounded here in Minnesota who are telling me they are not going to build here. They're going to go to the Dakotas or Iowa. And it's because of the permitting system. So we may have a permitting system that has some good things about it, but there's something incomplete about it as well that we've got to address. If it's a federal issue, then the Dakotas and Iowa would not be, they would be experiencing the same exact problems. And so what I want to ensure, we're not Congress, so we can't address federal issues, but if we see a disparity with our bordering states, I do believe that we can address those issues, and that's what I'd like to be able to do through this committee. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, Mark Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gordon, thank you for coming. I grew up in Wadena, so I know that there's a few turkey farms around there. And oh, by the way, you're very eloquent in your frustration with the federal and state regulations. So I don't know if I could have that type of composure. My one question is that you were talking about turkey expansions, but my question is more so in the last, I don't know if I want to go 5 years, 10 years, do you have any figures as far as any new turkey operations in Minnesota? You know, is it, you know, are we adding one or two a year, or just trying to get a feel for where we are for our projections?
Mr. Gordon.
Chairman McKeel, Representative Anderson. No, I don't. As the president of the Minnesota Turkey Growers, it's just sort of having your finger on the pulse of the industry, and I don't have numbers of exact. You'll hear of a farmer building a barn or two here and there, but as far as new people coming into the industry building and joining, I would have to say that it's very, very low, if any, in the past few years. But there have been some established farms that have added a barn here and there, or torn one down and built a new one in its place. But the expansion has been, as far as barns, has been low. The turkeys just, with the efficiency over time, the turkeys, the expansion has been on the amount of meat that you can get out of the turkey. Just raising a few more of them in the facilities you have and getting more meat out of the ones that you do have.
Representative Anderson. Okay. Representative Paul Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And not to continue on this permitting thing, because we have other things to do, but
yes.
I would just add, I agree the NPDES is a federal permit, but yet it was also pointed out it's for a discharge, which these buildings do not do. So it begs the question of why. And a couple of years ago, as I recall, we tried to replace that federal NPDES with a state permit, and didn't work. It's still required of these operations to have these permits. So again, and that would be under the auspices of the MPCA if we had the state permit delegated from federal level. So I think we can still do more on the state level in terms of trying to come up with solutions at work, and that protect the environment, which we all want to do, and yet make the process a little bit easier.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, Representative Clark Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I could tell a long story about how proud I am that I get to be called Representative Clark occasionally, but I'll save that for another day. I want to pick up on what Representative Miller talked about, and I frequently hear about you know, the idea that producers, whether it be in industry or farming, are moving, attempted to move across the border, and yet I live in Nicollet County, and I've seen, witnessed a pretty broad expansion over the last generation, certainly even the last 10, 15 years, of both pork production and dairy production. And it seems to me, at least where I live, it's the opposite. And I'd just like to suggest maybe to Representative Keel or Representative Anderson that we get some definition on that. What is happening with growth or decline of pork production, livestock production, turkey production, et cetera? And so we're working on not on anecdotal suggestions or what's really happening. So I would hope we'd have some time in one of the two committees to look at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I'll put my two cents in here. Personal experience, my brothers have a hog operation. But more importantly, I think sometimes when we see the permitting issues, sometimes it's even lack of communication, and I think that would be a very good conversation to have about where we're at and what we're doing. We certainly want to be able to encourage businesses that have put it in their plan, like Mr. Gorton made the point, that we don't say, we're going to add another barn, so we'll do that next week. You put it in your business plan, and it takes a good year or so to do that. However, it becomes very frustrating when it's more than a year in your business plan, because things change. And if you're, I know in my brother's case, they work toward increasing their hog operation, so they're building a herd while they're thinking about adding a building. So there's a lot that goes into it. It isn't just that quick. And certainly, we need farmers want to follow the rules. They want to be good neighbors. And I know it's challenging sometimes. And I have to just point out this. I have an organic farmer down the road from me, and I see a lot of those turkey manure piles. So it does very well, and it's very interesting to see. But and that has to come a little ways from me, because there's a few turkey growers up by Thief River Falls, so probably the closest that it is. But anyway, thank you very much, Mr. Gorton. Did you have any other comments?
No. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Well, then we'll move on to Mr. Scott Walder. Would you please identify yourself again, and then go ahead.
Yep. Chairwoman Keel and members of the committee, good morning. I'm Scott Waldner. I serve as president of the Chicken and Egg Association of Minnesota, which I'll refer to as SEAM. I worked in the allied industry as a salesperson for Land O'Lakes since 1985. And just a little background, in 2000, Land O'Lakes bought Purina Mills, and we were referred to as Land O'Lakes Purina for a while. Now we're just Purina Animal Nutrition. So, but Land O'Lakes still is the parent company, so just want to make everybody aware of that. And my purpose is supplying technical services to farmers and growers of chicken and eggs. Similar to MTGA, SEAM is a membership-based organization. We represent Minnesota's chicken and egg producers, processors, and allied companies. My comments will be consistent with those of Mr. Gorton. As the saying goes, birds of a feather flock together. And we share a lot of common positions on policy issues because of the impact, positive or negative, on farm businesses and processes is similar. Minnesota's chicken industry has also had a long history of entrepreneurship and business success that started with individuals. SEAM represents two major commercial sectors of chicken production: broiler chickens and eggs used for table eggs, of course, and then further processed liquid and dried products. Minnesota raises about 50 million broiler chickens annually on about 200 farms. According to a study done by the University of Minnesota in 2011, each chicken has a direct economic value of $2.74 for an industry value of over $100 million. It takes about 6 weeks to raise a chicken to market weight, and it's one of the most efficient sources of protein, converting 2 pounds of feed into 1 pound of meat. GNP, formerly known as Golden Plump, is Minnesota's only major chicken company. It was founded in 1926 by the Helgeson family near St. Cloud, and maintained family ownership until last year when they were purchased by Mashoff Pork, which is also another family-owned livestock business, but as the name applies, they were in pork production. GNP has processing plants in Cold Spring and Luverne, Minnesota, and Arcadia, Wisconsin. Minnesota's egg production ranks seventh in the country with about 10.5 million laying hens, producing annually about 2.9 billion eggs. Our neighbor to the south, Iowa, is the leading egg-producing state with 57 million hens. But back in 1997, they only had 25 million hens. So the major growth in Iowa in the last 15, 20 years. They have taken some production from Minnesota by actively recruiting through their Iowa Economic Development Group. And over the past 20 years, Minnesota, a lot of Minnesota chicken farmers have chosen to expand in Iowa, largely in part because of the unpredictability of our permitting process. As a matter of fact, some of you may have seen the announcement yesterday. Rembrandt Foods announced that they will be building a $97 million egg processing plant in Winnebago County, just across the border. But let's take a look at some other Minnesota egg production. Sparbo is a family-owned egg company that celebrated its 60th anniversary in 2014. The company was founded by Bob Sparbo, and today is run by Bob's daughter, Beth Schnell. They're based in Litchfield, but they also have farms in Iowa and Colorado. Michael Foods, in addition to marketing a range of egg food products, is one of the nation's leading processors of eggs. And they purchase eggs from other farms, but they also own farms in Gaylord and Le Sueur, and their other production is in Nebraska. Rembrandt Foods, which I mentioned a few minutes ago, bought what was formerly known as Golden Oval Eggs at Renville. Golden Oval began as a cooperative started by area corn farmers wanting to add value to their corn. A few years ago, Golden Oval was purchased by Rembrandt Foods, based in Iowa, but is owned by a Minnesotan, Glenn Taylor, who also happens to own the Timberwolves and a number of other businesses. Daybreak Foods is based in Lake Mills, Wisconsin, but they also own an egg processing plant in Long Prairie and contract with area farmers for egg production. The Bear Brothers are a family-owned farm in Lake Park that produces eggs, and they own a processing facility in Perham that is also supplied by independent egg producers. Loma Egg Ranch is north of Hinckley and is run by the daughters of the founder of the company, Mr. Ted Loma. Boersman Farms near Cokato is a multi-generational family-owned business that has expanded in Minnesota recently. Minnesota-based Cargill has Kitchen Solutions, their egg processing division that's based in Monticello. They are a major purchaser of eggs here in the Midwest. And there are also several Minnesota farmers that produce eggs organically for that specific market. They're primarily based in the southeast part of the state. Consumption of eggs is kind of an all-time high here with about 261 eggs last year. The industry will have to adjust to the recently implemented California law, making more investment in building barns necessary. So we'll have to see where that takes place. One of the other hats that I wear is representing SEAM on the board of the Midwest Poultry Federation, which is owned by the poultry associations in eight upper Midwest states. And we host a large regional poultry convention every year. This year it's March 17th through 19th at the River Center in St. Paul. And over 2,000 poultry industry personnel from across the country, as well as some foreign countries, will attend. And I would invite anyone here to attend. For more information on the Chicken and Egg Association of Minnesota, I invite you to follow up with our lobbyist, Bruce Clavin, and Executive Director, Steve Olson. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Waldner. Members, do we have any questions for, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Waldner, I appreciate, thank you very much for that presentation, and I'm sorry to hear that Rembrandt has decided to build a big production plant in Iowa, but I am excited. I was told yesterday about the project down in Renville, which is one of my towns, and I understand that's going to produce 20 to 24 jobs in that area with that expansion. And I'm also excited to know that the new permitting that takes only 90 days, their goal is to open production first quarter 2016, I understand, which is much more than 90 days from now. So please keep me informed. I'm excited to see how this project goes, and hopefully it can go as smoothly as what's being promised. So thank you. Please keep me informed.
Mr. Waldner, do you have any comments at all?
Rest assured, I will.
Representative Paul Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Waldner, thank you for being here. You touched on the California Proposition 2 out there being passed and the changes not only in California but maybe throughout the nation in terms of egg production. I read that the number of chickens out there is declining. The price of eggs is skyrocketing, one report said out there. Could you talk about what has to happen in terms of Minnesota, for example, now shipping eggs out to California? What has to happen to meet their standards to be allowed, pending court challenges to this law and interstate commerce, but what has to happen now to ship eggs out to California under this new law?
Mr. Waldner.
Gerald McKeel and Representative Anderson. The requirement now is 116 square inches per chicken, so producers in this state will either have to build new facilities to accommodate that, or they'll just simply have to reduce the number of chickens in their cages. We are at an extreme disadvantage here in the Midwest if that goes into effect. We will simply have to add additional heat to the buildings, which we do not have to do now. So we're at an economic disadvantage. But yeah, anybody that's shipping eggs into California now has to adhere to that rule.
Representative Anderson, you have any questions?
Well, just to follow up, and I assume for those that may not know, in a barn that's full, the animals generate enough heat to heat it themselves, and now by lowering the numbers, you'd have to heat with propane or some other source of heat, correct?
Mr. Waldner?
That is correct, yes.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks to both of you guys for being here today. I live up in Roseau, and Roseau County, the home of John Burkle, the former president of the National Turkey Growers, and Doug and Linda Hedlund, who were recognized as the Turkey Growers of the Year a couple of years ago. I want to follow up on the Prop 2 stuff if something like that were to come to Minnesota. It's my understanding in conversations with those guys up there and the Stoppenekers and so forth that there's fewer and fewer free-range turkeys today than there have been in the past. Now, I realize in many parts of the state they didn't free-range them that much, but up in my area, that was a big deal. So Prop 2 seems to be almost... I mean, if something like that were to happen in Minnesota, what would be the effect on the turkey industry, first of all? I mean, how would that... It's different, the square footage and so forth.
Mr. Gordon, would you like to answer that?
I guess to answer it correctly, I should know, but Proposition 2 is the no cages. In Minnesota, my farm included, we used to raise turkeys outside in the summer on what we called range, which is equivalent to a pasture. We quit doing that 12 years ago, as did the vast majority of the state of Minnesota. There's only a handful of growers in the north of Thief River Falls that still do it. It is so much better for the turkey to be raised in a safe, climate-controlled barn where you can control the temperature. There's not animals wandering in and out. It is so much better for the barn to be so much better for the turkey to be raised in a barn. And turkeys are not raised in cages like chickens, so I don't see much of a change for the turkey industry.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I did want to just touch on it. It is becoming fewer and fewer, and a lot of the reason why there's fewer range turkeys today, like you said, has to do with some environmental concerns, has to do with predators in my area. You know, there's a lot of people that like the idea of a range turkey, but the reality is that for a variety of reasons, they're becoming more and more scarce. So, and if I may, Madam Chair, one more.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. You know, we've had some discussions here, not some, a lot of discussions about permitting, and over the last 4 years, I've tried to do a lot of work on permitting, and you know, maybe the NPDES thing, we should revisit that. I know I've got a bill. I've been working with Colin Peterson, my U.S. Congressman, on 404 permitting, and you know, to Representative Clark's comments. You know, we hear these things, and we know it'd be nice to have hard data and so forth. But the reality is that from so much of Minnesota, we're hearing about delays and consumption of time and effort and money and so forth to get these permits in place. And when I talk to people who had a canola crushing plant in Minnesota and one in Oklahoma, the timelines are so much different. And in the end, what comes out of their air discharge or what comes out of their water discharge is no different. So just kind of the point here is that we have to just keep bringing the message to legislators both here in St. Paul and in Washington that we can do better. So thank you for your work.
Either gentleman want to make a comment? Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Waldner, thank you for your testimony. I want to comment. Eggs are a favorite snack for me, and I like a mid-morning snack, and I had a hard-boiled egg before this committee meeting, so I'm satisfied right now. Just a comment. I want to make a comment before I ask another question about the speed of permitting and the processes. I've said this in the last couple of years. I'll say it again, and I'll likely say it again in the session. I'm a professor, and when my students talk about how it's too hard to do the job, but when I give them an assignment, it's too hard, and I don't have enough time to complete it, I just say, yes, you can, and I challenge them. And I am very comfortable challenging state government to do the same thing. I think there's a lot that can be done to speed up processing of permitting, making decisions by state government. And I agree with my colleagues here who are saying that we need to do that, and I think we need to be vigilant about that. I also demand high quality from my students, and I ask for a high quality paper. And similarly, I ask for the same from the state, to be vigilant to make sure that the permits are given to protect what we're trying to do. So I think there's some real common ground there. With respect to the egg industry, I'm curious about the organic and the free range chickens, because I've been shopping at Cub, and partly because I have access to a fairly nice variety of free range organic chickens, and I find that they're priced quite differently, and I'm always curious about that. But my question is, are you seeing an increase in organic eggs and free range eggs, and an increased demand by the consumer in other parts than what seems to be at Cub Foods in West Mankato?
Mr. Waldner.
Chairwoman Keel, Representative Johnson, yes, we are seeing a slight increase in organic and cage-free eggs, probably more cage-free than organic, but at the end of the day, it still only represents 5% of the eggs consumed nationally, you know, is organic and cage-free. So it's a growing market, but it's not growing by leaps and bounds. And thank you for eating an egg. Have two tomorrow.
There you go. Let's see. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure, since we're on TV and the kids at home might be watching and scared of Prop 2 coming, Minnesota is not an initiative referendum state. It's not. I mean, we've been talking about government by anecdote here. Now we're talking about government by hypothetical that can't happen. I know of no bills introduced for any Prop 2 type of legislation which would require to go through this committee, which I don't think it would pass if it did, and I don't think it'd pass the House. I don't think it'd pass the Senate. I don't think it'd be signed by the governor if it was coming, but I know of none that exists, nor has existed, and I don't think it will exist. And if it did, it wouldn't pass. So, you know, I kind of agree with Representative Johnson here that we can talk about all the bad things that are potentially going to happen or could happen, but your industries seem to be adapting and growing. You know, I've been around long enough and grew up on a farm. I remember hearing about how all the businesses were moving to South Dakota. Now I'm old enough that if that was going to happen, South Dakota would be full. Hasn't happened. Now, some are moving, I acknowledge that, but I think evidence-based legislating is very important so that we are dealing with reality rather than anecdote. And I think when you, if you provide us with specific issues, whether it's environmental review and permitting, and those are two different things, environmental review and permitting, or if it's a question of not having the staff or people leaving, we want to make sure you have the ability to flourish wherever you are in the state. And I think that innovation that we have, and we want to make sure you've also got the research machine going at the universities and at the Minsku colleges to provide you with good workers and to have responses to diseases that may be coming or other things that in this world economy get transferred and could wipe you out, frankly, if we have something move in that. And I'm worried about that. And I think we've got to make sure we're providing the research so that we can guard against some type of disease or a vector that comes in carrying a disease that impacts your industries. And so ideas on research, ideas on how to help out, I think are as part of this whole picture of how do we make Minnesota work. And whether it's a suburban district like mine or a rural districts like most folks here, or some urban districts, or even rangers up north like Jason, we want to make sure things are working. And evidence is very helpful for us. What specific things can we do? And I think you'll see people united on that.
We have two more people that would like to ask questions, Representative Bly and then Representative Miller. Members, I just want to remind you that we still are going to hear from Mr. Montgomery from the Department of Ag. So we'll wrap it up with those two questions and then move on. So Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chairwoman Keel. And this is sort of a comment. I'll try to get a question out of it. But I not too long ago, it was discovered that I have heart disease. And this caused me to look a lot at nutrition and ways to change my diet to increase my health. And hearing the conversation about free pasture-fed or caged chickens or whatever reminded me that in my reading I came across before I say this, I want to say, you know, I know that with food science we look at various things and it seems like you can read one week in the paper that something's good for you and the next week it's bad for you. But but at any rate, the distinction for someone with heart disease often has to do with looking at the fatty acids, whether it's omega-3 or omega-6. And scientists who study these things have discovered that omega-6 fatty acids often come from corn feed and other kinds of feeds that are come from seeds, and that chickens who are fed primarily on chicken or on corn or other kinds of feed have that more likely to be in their system. And so when you eat an egg that is not pasture fed, you're more likely to get those kinds of fatty acids, as opposed to a chicken that is pasture raised has more likely to eat some grass or some other leafy things, and it's the leafy vegetables that have omega-3. And that's true of whether you find omega-3 in fish or where you might find it, because the fish are eating the leafy seaweed or whatever it might be that gets into their systems. So, and I know and I appreciate the efforts of farmers in Minnesota to grow and raise the healthiest food that can be produced. And I think that's part of the reason that we see the regulations that we have in place that want to make sure that farmers are doing the right thing and raising food in the right way. And I'm proud of our efforts. And I also know that we have some extreme challenges with our weather and all kinds of things, and you mentioned having to make sure that the birds are safe in barns and all of that. And this is an extreme challenge that we face, trying to address the new information about things that affect our health and producing the food that's going to be the most helpful. And I'm just wondering if either of you have a comment on that observation.
Mr. Walder?
Chairwoman Keel and Representative Bly, I think all those statements you said are true, you know, and I'm just speaking from the egg side now. You know, yes, we are feeding different diets to different chickens to produce different results, and if your health is such that you need more omega fatty acids, by all means, you know, find an egg that does that for you. So, yeah, constant research being done on eggs and egg products.
Thank you. Representative Bly, do you have anything? Okay.
No, thank you. Thank you for your comment. I appreciate that.
Representative Miller?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mine is actually a request to the committee. I actually support what Representative Hansen and Representative Johnson are suggesting. We need to come to the actual truth, and I would welcome a study. Perhaps we can discuss it in the future, welcoming a study to investigate the growth of animal ag in Minnesota and the surrounding states and perhaps the causes in those findings.
Okay, it is noted. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I really appreciate you both coming and talking about our poultry industry, and thank you also for commenting on the importance of agriculture education and how we need to encourage our students to look into agriculture, because there's a lot of opportunity there, and we certainly need to be able to provide that. So, but you have a nice day, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now we'd ask Mr. Montgomery to come forward, and we are going to talk about Agricultural Fertilizer Research and Education Council. I don't know if I can pronounce that. AFRIC. Oh, like the duck.
Yeah.
No. Sorry, Mark. Mr. Santos, I had to look twice, like, oh, you look a little different today than 2 days ago. But
Chair,
welcome.
Chairwoman Keel, thank you. Truth be told, I just nicked a little too far into the burly beard I had, but you know, the better joke would be to say I knew we were going to be televised today, and this is going to be my only chance to debut, so I had to look my best for you all and for anybody watching online. I would add, while Bruce is getting set up here, that the previous testimony about free range and barn poultry, as somewhat of a public service announcement, on January 25th, USDA put out a warning to Minnesota, because it is the number one turkey state, that they had found high path influenza in flocks in California, Oregon, and Washington. It's been known for some time. This is what's called the Pacific Flyway, and they catch it from wild birds outside. So it's biosecurity has become a real issue for Minnesota's flocks, and making sure that they have that biosecurity, because when birds are outside, it's typically they catch this from wild birds, typically fowl. So the northern flocks, as the duck hunters call them, come down and bring this highly contagious pathogen to the flocks, and certainly in the Pacific coast, that's become a real problem. We do not have any current confirmed cases in Minnesota, but if we would, we would be responding very quickly in conjunction with not only our partners in the poultry industry, but also with USDA and the University of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Cruz. It's good to know that that's... my question, just real quickly, is do free-range poultry have more of a problem then? More exposure, let's say, to a disease?
Chairman Keel, certainly they're more exposed to wild birds than you would be in a typical turkey barn. That's from anecdotal knowledge. I grew up in the second largest producing turkey county, which is Stearns County, Minnesota. And certainly there, I grew up around a lot of free-range turkeys that eventually moved into barns, and now I think it's almost exclusively barns.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Montgomery, welcome, and would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Absolutely. Good morning. My name is Bruce Montgomery, for the record.
I'm with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I am the section manager of what's called the non-point fertilizer section, and I have the absolute great fortune of working with about 22 fantastic agronomists, environmentalists, soil scientists, staff to help us work on statewide groundwater quality issues. So I want to share you, to me today, it's an absolute pleasure to have a few minutes to share a few comments with you regarding, I think, a very important program, and that's AFREC, or our Ag Fertilizer and Educational Council. So I'd like to give you a quick overview of the program in the next few minutes, and then leave some time for a few questions, if you don't mind. So let me first talk just a little bit about what the mission of AFREC is, and maybe before I even go into that, I just want to iterate that I'm speaking for the Department of Ag this morning. We have a very interesting and unique and very strong relationship with the council that advises AFREC. The Department of Ag works closely with this organization to help make sure that a lot of the administrative responsibilities are conducted properly. We provide facilitation, technical support to the council, and we also do a lot of the grant management aspects of the program. Just in a nutshell, the mission of AFREC is to improve fertilizer use efficiency. That translates into better farm profitability, and also we strongly believe it's very beneficial for the agricultural environment as well. The way this is done is through leadership of the securing of long-term funding, leveraging and coordination across the farm organizations, industry, and academics, as well as the Department of Ag. So hopefully it will be clear by the end of my presentation what I'm rambling about here. But I'd like to first quickly reference the legislative report that was just due the first of this month. We were required to report, the department's required to report on AFREC advancements every other year. And I just wanted to quickly go through a few key parts of the report for you this morning. In terms of what we've gotten done, first of all, the program's been around since 2008. So since that time, we've funded close to $4 million in soil fertility research and associated educational programs. AFREC, in partnership with the Department of Ag, to get this money out the door, we do that in a way through an RFP process. So since 2008, we have issued six separate requests for proposals, which the department manages. And during that process, we've generated almost 120 grant applications. And the request that we get, obviously we can't fund everything that is requested, but the request that we've gotten over those six RFPs is in excess of $13 million. The department has managed 77 individual awards, and although this money that's generated through our fertilizer tonnage fee is open for anybody to compete with, about 96% of those dollars go to the University of Minnesota, either through the land grant or the experiment stations that we have scattered through the department. I'm going to reference just a few things that I think speak well to the program, and on page 9 of the report there was a paragraph in there that I think is worth noting, and I'll just read parts of it to you quickly. But since the formation of AFREC, there's been stronger communication and coordination within the major commodity groups and fertilizer industry. Never before did all interested parties have reason to convene and discuss mutual challenges, shared goals, and a united response. While AFREC plays an important role in funding, it serves equally important role to bring commodity groups, crop production retailers, researchers, and the department together to discuss soil fertility issues. I think that this next graphic illustrates that to some capacity. One of the things that you might be interested in knowing is what types of crops do we fund research and education for. And at the beginning of the development of this program, I think there was some real concerns that some of our secondary crops might not get the funding or the recognition that they need. If I look at where that roughly $3.6 million has been spent since the life of AFRAC, we can see we have a fairly diverse profile here. Even though about 80% of our fertilizer use in the state goes on to the corn-soybean rotation, you can see that we have funded a number of different projects. And quite frankly, a lot of these projects are very non-crop specific. So advancements in soil testing, the use of precision ag, aerial imagery, those are all things that, that can help many different types of our agricultural systems. Obviously, wheat and small grains is an important one for us. About 4% of the overall funds have gone into sugar beet research. That industry has had a checkoff program for many, many years, and they fund a lot of their own genetics and research in-house. If you notice on the cover of the report, you're going to see kind of a strange crop. That's actually commercially grown paddy rice. The state is one of the national leaders in cultivated wild rice production. We have about 20,000 acres in northern Minnesota, and we are currently funding a project in partnership with the Cultivated Wild Rice Council. And I think that project, along with the numbers, really strongly suggests the types of cooperation and partnership there has been between the commodity groups, some of these specialty crops, and the ag industry. If we again take that pot of money that's been allocated and then dissected across different research topics, what we're going to see is the number one concern when this program was put together was concerns that the University of Minnesota's fertilizer recommendations were not adequate. And that was one of the founding issues that drove the formation of AFRAC during the 1990s and during the 2000s. The University of Minnesota lost an enormous amount of staff, and that translates into students and research because a lot of the state funding and federal funding that was typically available during that time period started to dissipate. And it was during the mid-2000s that we put what was called the Ag Nutrient Task Force together. The legislature directed us to do that as a department, and that's really kind of the roots of this program that evolved into AFRAC. And one of the big concerns driving it was that the university recommendations were outdated, that farmers and the ag professionals really questioning the value of those recommendations. And I'm really glad to say that there's been a lot of emphasis put into that area now over the last, since the formation of AFRAC in 2008. About 60% of the funding right now goes into revising or revisiting those soil recommendations, and that's particularly true in this high-yield environment that we're in now. And a lot of growers are questioning the past recommendations, and are they good enough, considering we're pushing yields that we've never seen before. So that part of it, I think, is really well in hand. What my guess is over the next 10, 15, 20 years, wherever AFRAC takes us down in the future, that some of those funds will now be diverted into some of these other areas of the pie. And obviously improvements in soil testing or plant testing, that's going to continue to evolve. There's always questions about fertilizer placement, particularly when we start using products like sulfur and zinc. These are micronutrients that we traditionally have not seen crop response to, but with this high yield environment, with decreasing sulfide emissions in the air, a lot of times these micronutrient deficiencies pop up where we traditionally don't see them. The other thing that I think the public is really looking for this program to provide some leadership in is on water quality. And though the council has not spent an enormous amount of money in the water quality, I think there's more and more interest in this area all the time, particularly as we can partner with other funding streams like Clean Water Legacy Amendment and other opportunities down the road. I know there's a number of educators here in the membership here, and one of the things that the council really tries to do is keep at least 10% of the total budget, and that's an $800,000 a year that's available for AFRAC distribution, is to make sure that we have plenty of educational support, either through web design, our partners at the Extension Service making sure that we have plenty of ammunition to make sure there's technology transfer that's going out the door on a very timely basis. So I guess the last thing I'd say about that is that there's also been some interest in bioenergy and biomass production, particularly down the road where these things are going to go. So they've continue to dabble in that area as well. We've funded a huge number of projects. Those are all listed in your report. If you want to see Appendix 1 in the back, all of those projects are listed. I just wanted to showcase in just a couple of minutes that we have some of the new awards for 2014. And the reason I bring this up is I'll just read the first three projects on the docket here that were funded last spring. Nitrate and tile drainage water relative to time and source of nitrogen application. That is a project by Dr. Fabian Fernandez at the University of Minnesota. This is a joint project that we're doing in partnership with the Minnesota Corn Growers. The Corn Growers made that position at the University of Minnesota a reality a couple of years ago, and AFRAC is funding some of the research to take advantage of that new position that's really here to help us with a lot of the nitrogen response and nitrogen environmental issues that we're faced with across the state. So we look forward to that partnership. The second one is connecting Minnesota farmers to AFRAC soil fertility research. This is through a private company called Broadhead. They're a public relations and communications company, and that they're helping us with our web design and making sure that the technology is keeping up with what some of our younger farmers are going to need in terms of apps and how we download information and get that information available quickly, whether they're in a combine or in a pickup visiting with their egg dealership. We're just about ready to launch a new website through Broadhead in the next few weeks. And they've also been very instrumental in making sure that there's a whole series of news articles in the Farmer magazine and other vehicles that we traditionally don't get to through traditional extension education programs. The third one down is got a bunch of technical names in it, but basically what we're trying to do, and one of the big challenges in this state, is really trying to understand nitrogen processes as it relates to mineralization. And this has been a high-profile funding priority for not only AFRAC, but also the Minnesota Corn Growers. They have put an enormous amount of money into this. But what we're trying to do is better understand the relationships of mineralization across the landscape. We've been blessed with very, very good soils in the state, but trying to understand them is also quite difficult at times. But to make things like precision ag and varying nitrogen rates across the landscape or on the go, we need to have some real basic understanding of how different these mineralization rates are in terms of landscape positioning. So there's a number of programs either funded through AFRAC or through the corn growers. The soybean growers have also been funding some new projects, but this has really been a top priority for a number of our partners. So we have a number of programs and new projects moving forward. Again, we have $800,000 a year to allocate. A large percentage of what the council has been working on is called continuations. And if you look at the far right-hand side, you're going to see a column that says origin year. You're going to see some of these projects date back a few years. Soil fertility research is a very slow and sometimes painful process. One of the beauties of having a checkoff program like AFREC is the fact that we've got long-term funding to do the programs and do them on the right time duration that's needed. The top project, long-term phosphorus management, is a large project funded at all of the experiment stations. It's hosted through the Crookston, or the Northwest Research and Outreach Center, but it involves all of the land-grant research centers. And I think it really is one of many different projects that we have, but I think it's a great one because it just showcases the amount of coordination that goes across these research organizations, recognizing that we have very different soils and different cropping systems, but to really get to the heart of updating our phosphorus recommendations, some of these long projects are going to take considerable amount of time. We'll probably be funding this one for the next decade as they try to set the table. And this phase one is called the build period. So basically what we're trying to do is groom nitrogen or phosphorus plots at the experiment stations in place, and then the university researchers will have a great opportunity to start applying treatments, and we should have some extremely good and far-reaching phosphorus recommendations in the future as a result of that. As I said, in Appendix 1, we have a listing of all the projects that have been funded over since 2008. I'd encourage you to take a peek at those if you're interested. Just one last thing before I close is the fact that the amount of requests that we've had over time has tended to increase pretty dramatically, particularly in the last few years when the Council did start to get the full $800,000 of funding available to them. That started in the year 2012. You can see that we allocate $800,000 a year, but as you can see, the amounts of requests that we're getting are starting to really skyrocket. And fortunately, again, because of our partnership and affiliation with the commodity groups, they're in a position at times to pick some of these off. We do this jointly with them. But even though we have one of the largest checkoff programs in the state now, we have, because of our diversity in agriculture, because of the size of the state and the variety of crops that we grow, I think there's going to be a very long-term need for this program for a number of years. Okay. Santo reminded me that maybe we should just say a few things about the evaluation process and how this works. The department puts out the RFP for the $800,000 each year. The value of having the council is to really focus in on what those research priorities are going to be across the various commodity groups. There's 11 organizations that sit on AFREC, and you'll see that in your report who they are. The department actually has hired a research coordinator to help facilitate a lot of that discussion with the commodity groups. So we have some very focused research that's reflective of what the needs are out there on the farms. The proposals will then come in the fall when we're at the request in September. The committee members will review those over the months of November, December, and then at the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers Conference in Minneapolis in December, we will first start discussing the projects and which ones we're probably going to bring to the table in January. Normally there's oral presentations for most of these projects that they want to review, but the council does all the scoring. The Department of Ag, nor does the University of Minnesota make any of the funding decisions whatsoever. It's that 12-member council that makes those allocations based on the recommendations. We do go through a peer review process, more for the technical parts of and we're required by the legislature to do that. But it's a pretty thorough review process. So I think with that, if Madam Chair, if you'd like, we'd be very happy to try to answer some questions. And Greg Bezicki, our division director, is here as well if there's something that I can't answer for you. So thank you again for this opportunity. It's been greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Montgomery. I believe Representative Anderson, Paul Anderson, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Montgomery, thanks for the program or working on the program. I think farmers, by and large, totally support this as a way to be good stewards and yet to use fertilizer in the most efficient ways possible. Looking at some of the numbers in your report, when this legislation was passed back in 2006, 2008, fertilizer tonnage was about 2.5, 2.6 million tons. In 2012, it was over 3 million tons of fertilizer. And we're collecting more than $800,000 in the fund. And I think by what you say and what farmers think, we could be doing more in this area. So my question is, what happens to the money over and above the $800,000? Is that growing in another account, or what happens to that money?
Mr. Montgomery.
Chair, thank you. Representative Anderson, that's a great question. You're right. The last 3 to 4 years, we've seen a pretty large increase in our tonnage. There's a number of reasons for that. Obviously, some of it's due to the increased corn acres that we've seen over the last few years. But probably more importantly is the fact that I think growers are starting to understand that some additional plant nutrients need to be put on. I mentioned zinc and iron, sulfur before. We're starting if you look at our long-term use of N, P, and K, for those of you that aren't farmers, that's nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Those are our three macronutrients that we rely tremendously on to keep our production levels up. Surprisingly, those levels are almost flat over the last 20 years. But yet our production, particularly corn production, has gone up dramatically. And what we're seeing is not so much an increase in N, P, and K use, but what we're seeing is an increase in micronutrients, and we're also seeing a shift in lower percent nutrient products. So, for example, the use of anhydrous ammonia is decreasing at the expense of urea, which is a lower analysis product. So that's part of the reason that we're seeing the increase in the actual tonnage. To get to your question, though, regarding the flow of the tonnage fees and that, what's happening is, first of all, there's an $800,000 cap on the program. And the department also has to pay the indirect fees on roughly the $1.2 million that comes in over the last few years. So there's about $180,000 of indirect costs, because the state collects those fees as part of the fertilizer tonnage. We supply, and Greg Bezicki can address this in further detail, but we also supply a one full-time equivalent to make this program run. So those fees need to come out of somewhere. And the way the AFRAC is set up is the 40 cents a ton is an add-on to our fertilizer tonnage fees. So it was originally 30 cents a ton, and then when this was passed, it increased to 70 cents. So the entire 70 cents a ton goes into the fertilizer regulatory account, and then the 800,000 comes out of that, and everything that's left stays in the fertilizer account to do fertilizer-related work. So that also includes roughly the $180,000 of indirect costs. The last few years, though, the balance difference is about $150,000 to $160,000 that is used for other fertilizer-related programs. Would you like to add something to that?
Mr. Bezicki, would you like to respond?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Greg Bezicki. I'm the Division Director of Pesticide and Fertilizer Management.
Thank you.
Just a couple of things. First, before I respond to that question, I would just like to say that this is a great program. When it was first started, when it was first talked about in the mid-2000s, there was a lot of discussion legislatively and advisory groups and so forth. And
how to make this happen, even though we're about the 14th, I think, program that state that has this. It was unique to Minnesota, and it has done a lot of great things. I would urge the committee members to take a look at the report. We tried to keep it short and sweet and keep it to some of the basics. So to the question, I would like to respond using a couple of the graphs in this, so if you wouldn't mind if we could look through it. And Representative Anderson, I think the your question originates on page 9. If you look at the graph, you see the fertilizer tonnage. This is the complete tonnage. And you see it bouncing around and so forth. I'd like to draw the your attention to three times, three periods. The first was when this program was first being discussed. This is back around 2004, 2005. At that time, in committee and elsewhere, the average annual sales was $2.2 million. The 40 cents per ton, if you just do the simple math, that comes out to $880,000. Those were the numbers we used in the fiscal note back at that time. That's how the language was developed. In statute, if you look in the statute, it basically says that the grants are capped, as Mr. Montgomery said, at $800,000. So there was about at that time, we thought there was about an $80,000 plus or minus. And the idea was, if more dollars came in, well, that goes into the fertilizer account, the agricultural fund, and that could be used for, you know, support to this program or for whatever. But if it was less than that, it would come out of the account. So if the revenue wasn't coming in, the fertilizer account would be paying the difference up to $800,000, and we'd support it. So I said there's three periods. So there's that initial period. And then if you look at the period in time from about 2007 to, about 2010, you see that the fertilizer sales went up to about the $2.5 million. So now we're bringing in on this at 40 cents, about $1 million a year. So we went from 880 to about $1 million. With the staff costs and with the indirect fees and so indirect charges that the state has to pay, that's about the break-even point. Is 2.5 million tons of fertilizer, $1 million coming into the account. In the last few years, you can see that we've jumped up around 2.9, 3 point. So there is actually more revenue coming in than is going out. Now, if I could ask the committee to look at a graph on page 6. If you look at the graph on page 6, or not the graph, but the table, you'll see that it goes down on table 1 on the top of the page. It goes from 2008 down to 2014. There's a lot of numbers there, but the key thing is this funding source in the center column. In 2008, the program was originally funded with $600,000 in general fund to get the program off the ground. And then the fees were put into statute, but it takes a while when we do fertilizer collection for those fees to come in. So what you see is the increase in tonnage fees. That's when the department is actually collecting that $800,000. The time between 2008 and 2011 were actually dollars that were coming out of our fertilizer account without the new money coming in. So there again, there were three phases. One was general fund. One was paying for this program from our regulatory account, if you will. And then the third period in time is when we're actually paying the $800,000 out of the fees coming in. So that's kind of a little history of the three phases of it. Right now we're in a phase when there's actually more dollars coming in. And that just simply goes, according to statute, it goes into our account. And we try to keep our, as you can see, we try to keep the staff costs down. We run about 10% for the staff. We count it, we track all that and so forth. So we try to keep the administration of this to a minimum and make sure that the $800,000 is there. The rest of the dollars, if for some reason fertilizer sales were to drop down, we'd be paying out of this out of the account, and the revenue wouldn't be covering it. That's the way the statute reads.
Thank you, Mr. Bozicki. Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. No questions for me that the program is valuable. What I'm suggesting is maybe as fertilizer use has increased, we could increase the dollars that go to research. I think there's also a cap in statute on the administration costs of 8%, for example. And I understand some of these funds have to be moved around back and forth. But again, the number I have, it took in about $1.2 million last year in money coming in from farmers' payments. And I would like to see more of that money go back out to good projects, good research in the field. That's my comment.
And Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, the original language did have that 8%, but that was attached to the general fund at the time, I believe. So that's one, just for clarification to the committee. The other thing is that this program is designed to sunset in 2017, and I know the council members have had discussion about, okay, do we want it to continue? If we want it to continue, what do we want to do, and so forth. So I know that we're well aware that those discussions have been taking place. And the last comment, since this is the Finance Committee, the department does not have an initiative on this program at this time, but we're very much aware of the sunset clause in 2017.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Buzicki, just to be clear then, if we've taken in surplus, what is the balance that's in the account over and above the $800,000?
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, I don't have the balance for the entire fertilizer account. I apologize. I should know that. We have the fertilizer inspection account funds all of our regulatory responsibilities, and then of course the $800,000 of this comes out. I can get that for you. I apologize. I want to say the balance is about $2.5 million overall, but I'd have to check that. It might be a little bit higher than that.
Okay, Representative Fabian.
Well, thank you. You know, I would encourage the agency to work with the stakeholders here to work something else out. It doesn't, I mean, it's a great program, but we're generating a lot, and maybe we can make some changes to the program to make it even better.
Mr. Cruz.
Chairwoman and members, I've been in close consultation with the AFRAC board members. They were kind enough to invite me to their last board meeting, and I think also their meeting in Lamberton this summer, where I've been talking with Chairman Larry Muff and others about the strategies and the resolutions that they're looking at. And so I take your comment to heart, and we've already begun that work.
Thank you.
Representative Fabian? Are you? Okay. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question actually for Mr. Montgomery. You pointed out the photo on page one of the document indicated the person who's applying fertilizer to the cultivated wild rice plot. Can you tell me what is being applied there? It says nitrogen, but I mean what the natural wild rice fields and, you know, the as it's growing, that don't have these sort of things added. What is the purpose or reasoning, and how is this different from what's you know, occurring on the lakes out of the natural wild rice?
Mr. Montgomery.
Yeah, thank you for that question. Rice is one of those crops that responds quite favorably to the nitrogen inputs. And one of the fascinating things about nitrogen management in rice, it's very, very different than any other crop that we grow in Minnesota. Because of the submerged conditions, you know, the management, the opportunity for losing nitrogen to the atmosphere or through tile drainage when the crops are drained off before harvest. So it's really key that the nitrogen is managed correctly. A big problem that's in rice, and for those of you that grow small grains, it's somewhat similar, that if you get too much nitrogen into the system, you're going to get blodging, and then you get more disease problems. And even though you might increase your yields, you can't harvest it because it's lodged. So these researchers at the Grand Rapids Experiment Station, they're doing this type of research in partnership with the Wild Rice Council, is really trying to figure out what those nitrogen strategies are going to be. And we're funding some work to look at slow-release products like what's called ESN, which is environmentally smart nitrogen. It's a polyurethane-coated urea that could potentially be used for production. One thing I'd like to point out, the director of the Wild Rice Association was at our last AFRAC meeting, and what she told us internally was that each wild rice grower contributes, on average, $100,000 a year to continue rice production research. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but the cultivated wild rice is quite different than pure wild rice, and the fact that we manage inputs carefully. It's usually grown as an annual crop in rotation with soybeans and dry line potatoes. It's a very, very different cropping system. Many of us have never even seen it produced. A lot of times the nitrogen's flown on aerially on these larger pads to get the nitrogen on properly. So it's a very, very challenging crop to grow, both from an environmental point of view as well as a production point of view. But the economic value of this crop is quite substantial to Minnesota.
And Chair, Representative Clark.
So the photo of the fellow walking through there, he's actually applying it, and it looks like it's not the same thing as if you were applying it aerially, obviously, but this is a real hands-on application for a small plot, or what is he doing there?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Montgomery.
What this graduate student is doing is actually hand-applying different nitrogen rates to different parcels of that paddy and using different sources of nitrogen. As I said, ESN is one of those experimental products that we're working with that looks like it has a lot of promise for controlling nitrogen release. So what they're doing here in this photograph is basically doing replicated trials using different rates, different sources, and different timings of nitrogen.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, maybe this is a conversation we can have afterwards. Sure. I'd like to know more about polyurethane-coated anything that's put on fields and what happens to the polyurethane.
I've just put a plug in, Representative Clark. It might be nice to see what they do on an experiment station. I've watched the Northwest Experiment Station and what they're doing, and it's very interesting to see all the different tests they're running and what they're looking for in each one of them. So, members, it's almost done. Representative Hansen had a question. We should be wrapping up, though. Representative Hansen. Thank you, Representative Hansen. Well, Mr. Montgomery, Mr. Cruz, Mr. Buzicki, too, thank you very much for coming, members. We are meeting again February 10th, and we are adjourned.